Is there something that you think what you're describing is it's the emotion of the scene just kind of reached a point where you couldn't resist anymore? But is there a type of moment or type of work that has a tendency to make you cry? I know my answer to this. Okay, go ahead.
Injustice. Hello.
Hi.
I was going to say hello, everybody. But no, I feel a little quiet today, being resting from our trip and catching up with personal stuff. How are you doing?
Same. Our nice little whirlwind to New York, and then been nonstop events and things. Last night I had the great pleasure of cheering on my friend Jean-Nic Bontemps, composer of the new Transformers Rise of the Beasts, his first major studio film.
Amazing. Great cook.
He is an excellent cook. Chef Bontemps, bon appetit, as his custom-made cutting board says.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had food at his place, and that guy does not... go easy. He does not fuck around with food. He's like, if you're doing food, it's an all-day preparation process for him, which is probably why he hasn't done it in a while, because he's been so slammed just 24/7 on this movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But, I was really, really happy for him that he has this wonderful kind of new career milestone.
I saw his stories on Instagram, and it was very touching.
Yeah. I was in the room when he came walking in.
When it happened.
And, yeah, and everyone started cheering. Like, after the movie was over and we're all standing in the lobby.
I'm quoting Hamilton. Look, I should get a little...
I was in the room where it happened, but I couldn't see him. I just saw, like, the top of his head because I was standing towards the back. I was talking, actually, with Anthony Parnther, who had conducted the score, and we were just chatting real quick, saying hi, basically. And I heard everybody kind of cheering and screaming, and I assumed that Jean-Nic had been in the theater still talking to friends or something. And then the whole room exploded. And only when I looked at Instagram this morning did I realize that he was actually kind of teary-eyed and sort of letting it all hit him.
It's so nice to see somebody opening themselves publicly like that. He's not like trying to play it cool or, you know, like, yeah, whatever.
No, I don't think he tried to make it seem like somehow this is just normal life. He's just going along with it. It's a pretty huge deal. It's a completely life-changing project, financially, professionally, you know, in terms of your visibility in the industry, all that kind of thing. It opens up a lot of doors. It's those kinds of bigger projects are hard to get the first time. And it makes it infinitely easier to get a second one. You know, because now people know, okay, you can do it. You can survive.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm so happy for him.
Amazing. Very much same. But the result is that it's basically just been nonstop events and screenings, and I feel like every day I have to leave the studio earlier than normal in order to get out the door to stuff.
Angelie and her new studio.
Yep.
Also.
Yep, that was Monday night. And yeah, it's tonight we will finally see the Into the Spider-Verse, music by the amazing Dan Pemberton.
Yes, I'm so excited. Yep. I've seen so many things already. I'm like, no.
You always manage to get spoiled. Like, I don't know what it is about. How come I never managed to get spoiled?
This time I follow a few artists that worked on the movie, and they are like updating like their process and, you know, like showing some images. And so I'm like, I shouldn't see this. I'm just going to skip it. I'll try to not analyze. So every time I see like a very colorful Spider-Man image, I'm like, bye.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly why I priority to see it immediately. But yes, so we were in New York, and the main thing that we did was go see Anthony Rapp's one-man show called Without You, based on his kind of the book memoir that he wrote in the wake of Rent shutting down after many, many successful years and a movie and all the rest
Can
of it.
Can you tell me a little bit of Anthony, a little background?
So Anthony is a is an actor. He was, you know, living in New York, doing the actor thing of little bit parts in movies and plays and musicals and that sort of thing when he was cast in Rent. And it was a long process, you know, I think a multi-year process from the kind of initial little workshops and preview type things until it started on off-Broadway theater and then took on such popularity that it immediately migrated to a mainstay Broadway theater. And then they did, I should actually look up how many total performances.
Yeah, for how long they were like doing it?
It's a good question. Let me see. 12-year run.
Wow.
5,123 performances. 5,123. Ninth longest running Broadway show of all time. There was, of course, a touring production as well. So it's absolutely bananas.
Yeah.
Of course, the show also very famously, the composer, Jonathan Larson, died before it fully opened and kind of took off and never got to see what he had made. And then on top of that, shortly after it opened, Anthony had lost his mother. So he was living through this duality of the highest high and the lowest low. You know, losing a dear friend, a mother with whom he was very close, and then experiencing this career milestone, shooting him to the next level of professional achievement. And so he wrote a book just you know, telling that story and decided to turn it into a show. And it's been, it's just about closed. I suspect by the time this episode is published, it will be closed or like be a day away from ending, but it's been running off Broadway for several months. And it seems like it was pretty much always, you know, if not sold out, you know, thoroughly stacked theaters. I know that when we went Friday or Saturday night, it felt pretty damn full there, you know, the odd empty seat here and there, but I was like, for, you know, we were there for week 9 or 10 or something. And it was still, you know, pretty full. And you went in not knowing that much about him, correct?
Yes, I don't know. I had never seen Rent. I didn't even know what was that because we just don't watch much. We're not connected. Like in Costa Rica, we're not. Or at least the general public is not familiar with the musical world. So
it's not just Costa Rica. It's very much an American thing. And then like London has a very popular, like the London, you know, West End theater, places like that are legendary venues for musical theater. But when you think of touring productions, I never hear about, you know, the Rent production in France or Germany or so. It's like even in Europe, these things, they might do little one-offs.
It's very niche, but I think it's expanding quickly.
Well, it's not niche in America. It's huge business in America, but it seems to be uniquely American in this way. Like it's an art form that's not. It's not like movies or something, which are just absurdly universal. Even though movie musicals are, you know, like all you think of all the Disney animated musicals, for example.
Exactly. I was going to mention that we just know whatever movie, Disney movie or whatever, but nothing about the shows themselves. Like, obviously we're not able to watch them. So yeah, I didn't know anything about this. Still haven't seen it, but, I did understand a lot of it, and it was very touching.
Yeah, which kind of prompted our proposed subject for this week of just reflecting on times that art or artworks have made you cry.
Because you did.
I was very teary-eyed at Anthony's show. I thought it was absolutely beautiful, and there wasn't anything about it that I would change. And usually there's... Yeah. You know,
Yeah, you nitpicks. Always see this stuff with your with the technical,
yeah,
musical eye. But I think it was, it hit me as well, but I didn't show any physical emotion.
So let's just cut straight to that question then. Is there anything that has genuinely like made you shed tears across any medium? Like, is that because not everyone expresses themselves that way? Some people yes, cry at the of drop course. Of a hat and some never cry, you know, like Liam from Summerfall, Stray Gods, our executive producer, studio manager. He says how he rarely cries at things. It's like hard for him to cry. And he actually kind of doesn't like that because it feels like he ends up with something needing to be released that he can't. And it's actually kind of annoying. Whereas like Andrea, my friend Andrea Pacino, co-founder of Ready at Dawn, he cries at everything. I mean, he is a that hair is trigger.
So funny.
So if each one, if we think of them as the two ends of a spectrum, where do you land? And what is something that has made you cry?
There's very low chance for me to cry in general. But I have in the past with, let's see, Green Mile. The first 10 minutes of Up.
That one's rare what to escape. Else? Almost no one doesn't cry from that.
Interstellar.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Just knowing that he was there for a few months, but their kids were growing up resentful, and but he couldn't do anything about it, you know? There's a scene where he's just broken. That's, I was like, oh my God, I guess I just can't contain anymore.
Yeah.
So well, I remember that one was very touching. Well, not touching. It was hard.
Yeah. So on the Liam to Andrea spectrum, you're a lot closer to Liam, but things will reach you. Is there something that you think what you're describing is it's the emotion of the scene just kind of reached a point where you couldn't resist anymore. But is there a type of moment or type of work that has a tendency to make you cry? I know my answer to this. Okay, go ahead.
Injustice, when things are not fair.
Interesting. So interesting to interpret that opening scene in Up as unfair.
It's unfair because he lost everything and couldn't reach their goal on time.
Right. Yeah, I guess I've always seen it as the film portrayed it as just the quiet dignity of accepting life's challenges, but I suppose you could call it life's unfairness, and that's an interesting, I'd never really thought of it in those terms. That's a really interesting common thread. I would not have been able to, like if I line up Green Mile and Up and Interstellar, the idea of something feeling unfair is not what I would have, but that makes total sense. Is there anything other than films? Like has a song ever done that for you, or a painting, or a poem, or...
Oh, yeah. No, music, yes. I can't think of anything specific, but I have, of course, as a, you know, back in the day, in my teenage years, where every song was, like, about me. But I can't think of something right now. But no, yes, currently I haven't cried with music in a while and can't think of anything specific, but I'm not that person anymore. I don't cry at everything because everything is about me. I am more, I am less self-centered.
Right.
But I have with music. Music is really powerful. And I think music obviously is connected to all these films.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, it's part of the mandate of a composer to... Steven Spielberg, one of his little catchphrases is he often says... I can make a tear form in your eyes, but John Williams is the reason why it falls. That's one of his...
Oh my God, that is so cool.
That's one of his little lines I've heard him say a bunch of different times. You know,
amazing.
We think of those moments, those truly iconic... he has so many of them from E.T. and Indiana Jones. You know, like Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, when they're hanging over the cliff's edge, and Sean Connery, for the first time, calls him Indiana instead of Junior. And he goes, Indiana, Indiana, let it go. And you have the, you know, bum, 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 the theme for the father-son dynamic of Indy. And then, even as a kid, he pulls him up and he looks back, and as all the rubble is coming crashing down, and you hear that bum, 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 na, 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 the sort of very Catholic sounding religious theme for the Grail and the knight guarding it. That'll get me.
You know which one I remember? Hachiko.
The story? Or you mean the film that was made?
I haven't seen the film.
Yeah, I heard it wasn't great. But it...
But yeah, the story is just... it hits me.
I have a little Hachiko here in the studio. A little wooden one. Because Amin was obsessed with that story and wanted to make a movie about it until a big Hollywood movie got made, and he abandoned the idea. But he went to Japan, and he's a big dog lover. He went to Japan for a festival screening of Captain Aburaed and saw a statue of Hachiko and learned the story, and he bought a little wooden one and gave it to me. It's literally right, basically right there.
And you're corner of secrets.
Yeah, and that is an especially beautiful story.
For sure.
The
another injustice story.
Yeah, it's funny how, you know, the Hachiko's owner was quite old, as I understand. So it's funny how I have a hard time seeing someone dying in old age as injustice, even if it's sad for everybody left behind.
A dog.
But it's, I don't know, to me, it's just life. It's hard for me to call something unjust when it's just part of life, because to me, injustice feels like we did something wrong and we need to fix it.
No, it's more about like knowing that the dog doesn't understand that he's not coming back anymore.
Yeah, I guess this is where maybe I see a semantical difference between unfair and unjust. Like one feels unfair, feels like, yeah, that's unfair, but it is also just kind of life. Whereas to me, unjust feels like that's not fair and let's fix it. But this is just my own, I'm just explaining, I guess, why I wouldn't have thought to call it unjust, but I'm not disagreeing with you that it is unfair.
No, for sure. And I appreciate it because I don't know the difference. Like my English is not exactly.
Well, I might be making up a difference. Developed. To be clear, I'm explaining my reaction to those words based on what the subtext feels like to me, but I'm not like, I don't have Merriam-Webster up on my screen and I'm drawing from some official delineation. Like, I don't know that injustice has baked into it this subtext that it is somehow a fixable. I just think of the word justice being about like human creation, human laws or human practices, whereas fairness is more indifferent. It's not a human thing. It's a more just a life thing, a universal thing. But this is, I might be projecting these interpretations. But it's a really interesting. It is actually a very emotional, like a very justifiable reason to be so moved. And it also explains why Anthony's show wouldn't have necessarily pulled that out of you. Although, I mean, Jonathan Larson dying before he could see the fruits of what he made.
That is what exactly, what I didn't know anything about it. And then he mentioned that. And it made me feel quite, like, not upset, but I felt sadness. It's so weird to think that this person created this whole show and they didn't even see it live.
There's a couple examples of this throughout history. Bizet and Carmen, if memory serves, he died before. Carmen is considered one of the most famous and popular operas ever written, and Bizet never saw that success. It's funny. I think for me, I'm trying to think of the equivalent of just going injustice, like the one word kind of summary. But I think goodbyes, the idea of remembrance, even when it's a beautiful kind of remembrance, like like that song, that beautiful Irish song, the Parting Glass.
I remember that one. Oh, so good. Can I just play a little bit here? You think we're gonna be in trouble?
Play the Peter Hollins version.
Of all the money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company. And all the harm that e'er I've done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all.
That's a song that's so much about remembering those who've left us. And that idea, anytime I see goodbyes, that has a tendency to really get me. And I think that it can manifest in different ways. For example, one of the things that really moved me about it, Anthony's show, was that it's a one-man show, but there's a lot of scenes that essentially have multiple people in them, where he's kind of portraying himself in dialogue with his mother or with Jonathan or with fellow castmates. And when he's doing it where it's supposed to be a phone call, he did a really nice job at having kind of like a vocal filter that makes it sound like it's coming through the phone, and he would tweak his voice a little bit like his mother's sort of, you know, north, like Wisconsin kind of Michigan accent that he put on to be his mother. But even just the fact that it was kind of how that sort of filtered, like that right. Phone call quality with the real narrow frequency spectrum. But there was a moment that really stuck with me in the show where he was describing the sort of rehearsal process, and he was like, he just said, Jonathan was there, and he pointed at an empty chair on stage, and there was a little, you know, bit of a spotlight on it. And just that idea of, I want this person represented, but rather than an actor portray them, or rather than some kind of projected image or stand-in or a silly, like a cardboard cutout or some way to make it feel like that's that person. The poignancy of saying, they're not here. I don't want you to forget that they're not here. They're not here with us. The empty chair was so much more poignant. I one time saw the Pacific Symphony do a Leonard Bernstein celebration performance. This is the one I was telling you where his daughter Jamie came out on stage, and my brain had been so rewired to hear her voice as him because of that radio program where she read his correspondence, that it was surreal to be looking at her and hearing her voice and being like, but that's his voice, because I just listened to this thing so many times. But his most popular piece by far that he has ever written in terms of what orchestras play is the overture to Candide. And, you know, the thing starts off with the big brass. And, you know, everybody knows that piece. You know, it's just truly a masterpiece. So fun, so virtuosic. And the conductor, Carl St. Clair, who had been a disciple of Leonard Bernstein, who was conducting this whole show, he came out and he said, we're going to end with the Candide Overture, and we really want you to feel Lenny in the room with us. So we've prepared it to have no conductor on the podium so that you can just see him there yourself. And that orchestra played this piece with no conductor, which is crazy, because it is a bitchin' piece. It is so hard to play. It's so fast. And it was for a piece that's not emotional in the way of like pulling at your heartstrings. It's exciting. It's exhilarating. I couldn't help but cry because there was something so beautiful about the gesture of saying no one can replace him. So we're not even going to try. We're going to leave a Lenny-shaped hole for you to just picture him yourself. I thought that was so fantastic. I can't remember, that concert was probably 12 or 13 years ago.
Wow.
And I remember it. I feel it even as I'm talking about it. I feel how beautiful that was. And the idea that you...
You're level, Andrea.
Well, he and I are a lot alike in this regard. It doesn't take much to get me. I mean, Mass Effect made me cry. I can't tell you without spoiling anything, because, dear listener, I managed to convince her we're actually doing a playthrough of Mass Effect Trilogy. Yeah.
We've been playing for, what, like 5 hours maybe less?
Yeah, we're still pretty early in the first game.
Anyway.
But there are things in the third game that really move me to tears. And as I think about it, I'm realizing it has the same common thread, you know, and there's something, I don't know, goodbyes, and also that idea of looking back. There's that beautiful line in Saving Private Ryan where he's reflecting on his commander's, everything he did for him. And then he turns to his wife and he says, tell me I'm a good man. And it just kills me. It's just so beautiful and so emotional. I think it's goodbyes, and goodbyes are representative of just that wistful looking back and saying, you know, I did the best I could. There's a great line in Firefly where Malcolm Reynolds is talking to it's in Serenity where he's talking to Shepherd Book, and he says something like, you know an awful lot about the Alliance for a preacher. And he says, someday, and he goes, I wasn't always a preacher, Mal. And he says, someday you'll have to tell me about that. And he goes, no, I won't. And it's meant to be kind of a cool moment. Like, this guy was probably a badass, and we're never going to know, like, what that means. But to me, there's something, it's more wistful than that. I see it as him going, I've said goodbye to that chapter. I wanna try to end my life with as much peace as I can. I wanna go out on a quiet note.
Yeah, I thought that Anthony had a really great line. Can't remember how he phrased it, but when he's like next to his mom in bed and just told her, I give you permission to go. I can't remember exactly, but you can go. It's okay. It's gonna be okay. I'll be fine.
Yeah, that tore me to shreds because that is essentially the last thing I said to my own father. It is literally the last thing I ever said to him. His last day and a half or so, he never really had the ability to communicate with us, so he was essentially asleep the whole last couple days.
Yeah.
But there was a moment. I remember sitting next to him, and he woke up and looked at me, and I realized the little windows of him being awake and conscious had gotten pretty small, so I just leaned in and whispered into his ear, I want you to know that you've done a good job, and I feel prepared to tackle the world without you. And you know, it wasn't you can go, it wasn't like fighting to stay on. He was miserable, actually. I think he wanted it to end. It was a horrible, his body was all messed up. But I wanted him to have the satisfaction in what little bit of cognizance he had to know that I wasn't actually afraid. And earlier in life, I probably would have been. You know, like if he had died when I was a teenager, I wouldn't have felt prepared. And it would have been much harder. And it was easier to cope because he had been a good dad. And it was never about, I want to take care of you. And I want to provide for you and blah, blah, blah. It was always, I want to arm you. You know, he always would say to me, you know, you can feed a man for a day by giving him a fish, or you can feed him for life by teaching him how to fish. That was one of those many axioms that he.
Wow, so Christian.
I don't think that's a Christian.
Religious.
Yeah.
Keep it like that.
Maybe. I was looking for the lyrics of The Parting Glass, where he says, "Fill to me the parting glass and gather as the evening falls, and gently rise and softly call good night, and joy be to you all. Of all the comrades that e'er I had, they're sorry for my going away, and all the sweethearts that e'er I had, they'd wish me one more day to stay. But since it fell into my lot that I should rise and you should not, I'll gently rise and softly call good night, and joy be to you all." I absolutely love that to death. Just this beautiful notion of, it's my time. Raise a glass in my honor. I'm going to another place. It's just, there's so many moments, like that moment in the end of Lord of the Rings, you know, when they're saying goodbye to Gandalf as he's about to sail off to Valinor, and then Frodo steps forward and is going to go with him and leave Sam and Merry and Pippin behind in the Shire, and he has to go. He's like, I can't live in this world anymore. It's the same idea. And then, of course, bringing it home and to our album of the day and all that, perhaps my favorite film of all time is Zemeckis' Castaway. And that score had less than 20 minutes of music, and it's basically the same cue just a few times. Mm-hmm. There's no music in that film until he manages to get off the island. And so it's like, you know, an hour and 45 minutes or something into a 2 hour and change movie before you even hear music.
Injustice.
It's true. Yep. That is one where
I was sobbing with my mom with that one.
Oh yeah. That's one of those movies that I see the last 20 minutes with no context, if it's like 2 p.m. on a Saturday and I've been eating chips and salsa and playing with the dog, and then I turn it on and I catch it'll still hit me like a ton of bricks. Wow. Like, it's one of those that I am an absolute unsheathed live wire with that film. And what I love is that it's not the sadness, it's the poignancy. It's the fact that he has to say goodbye to mm-hmm. his life. He's given this second chance, but he can't reclaim what he had, and he knows it and she knows it. And they both accept that, even though it's painful. You know, that scene where she's in the rain and she's saying, "You were the love of my life." Mm-hmm. And then it's like, yeah, sucks. And there's the beautiful, one of my little favorite things I remember my dad pointed out when I saw that movie, we saw it together, I saw it several times in theaters, is that the movie is not the noun castaway, which is one word. Castaway refers to somebody who's been lost at sea or something. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. two words, cast away.
Yes.
And it blew my mind when I discovered this little trick they played.
That's a kind of thing that I will never understand if I don't know English, because for us, it was translated as the person who's lost. It's naufrago.
Yeah, that is...
That's literally that. Like, there's no other context.
That is a shame. Yep. It's so different, because the idea that he was lost, the whole movie is all about these crossroads. What do you do when you reach a fork in the road? How much is your life going to change? You know, he has the decision to get on the plane or not. And then one of his big struggles is that he wants to kill himself on the island and he can't. He feels imprisoned. And then he decides, okay, I'm going to take my chances out in the open water. And then when he finally makes his way back, it all culminates in him just standing at this intersection of dirt roads in the middle of nowhere mm-hmm. and deciding, well, I can go that way, I can go that way. And it's just, I would be hard-pressed to think of a more perfect film. And the score is so simple. English horn, oboe, played by Tom Boyd. Strings, and then some piano for the ending credits. It's as simple as a score can get. It's over and over, just these simple little A-flat mm-hmm. major chords playing through this simple and absolutely gorgeous tune. I remember it wasn't even released on CD initially because it's so short. It was like, what wow. do we even do? So they released an album of the best of Silvestri Zemeckis, which had bits of all the Back to the Futures and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Death Becomes Her, Forrest Gump, Contact, and Castaway, and that was the only way to get the Castaway music. It had a little edit of music from.
Do you have it?
Of course, absolutely.
Just make sure.
It was a great album because it was a wonderful overview of how eclectic their career had been. You know, back mm-hmm. between Back to the Future and Romancing the Stone, and then these wild comedies like Death Becomes Her and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and then of course the absolute beauty of Forrest Gump and Contact, and a horror film, What Lies Beneath. You know, it's really pretty amazing. They have a truly incredible partnership. But Castaway for me is the zenith. It is the absolute, like, because I love Forrest Gump. To me, that is a really special film. And I really love Contact, mm-hmm. despite, you know, the changes. And I'm one of the people that will defend the movie. I would acknowledge that the book is even better. I love the book as well. Carl Sagan meant a lot to me. But I love the movie. I think I did do a good job. I will defend it against its critics. It is slightly more on the nose about the religion versus science than the book is, but Castaway, yeah, that one really gets me.
Album of the day.
It is indeed. I was going to say there's also, I won't say what it is because you've finally started kind of dipping your toes in the world of Buffy and Angel. And another thing that has made me cry, just absolutely devastated me, is the episode of Angel called A Hole in the World. And for anybody that knows that show, they'll know what I'm talking about. That episode, and I can make it like a corollary song of the day, is Kim Ritchie's A Place Called Home, which... What I love is that if you go look on YouTube of uploads of that, they all, you'll see in all of the comments, mentions of Angel, because they licensed that song over this beautiful scene, this powerful, gut-wrenching scene. And it was so memorable as a combo. The song is so lovely that I think it's a beautiful song that anybody would like. But when you have this turbocharged association.
Do I know
it? I'm sure I've shared it with you before. And because you haven't seen the episode, you were like, oh, it's nice. You know, that's like, I don't expect it to be something that tears your guts out.
Yeah.
So aggressively without that context, even though it is beautiful. It also has some really lovely lyrics in it. Someday I'll go where there ain't no rain or snow. Till then I travel alone and I make my bed with the stars above my head and I dream of a place called home. Great lyric. I don't know anything about Kim Ritchie other than that this song, I think, is kind of her, you know, her sort of biggest hit. And I'm sure Angel's a big part of why. But in any case, it's the same sentiment. It's the same. I don't know. I think there's a handful of things that really get me. but
yeah, you can't pick one.
Yeah. In any case, all right, well. So injustices, unfairness, / the beauty and pain of looking back and making our goodbyes or trying to make our peace.
I think that's great.
Those are our triggers.
Yeah.
All right. That's it. Mm-hmm. And big love to Anthony for a beautiful show. It's a shame that we're recording this where basically if you haven't already seen it, you're not likely to. Otherwise, I would say everybody who's in the New York area, please go see it. But you can read the book, which the show is a sort of an adaptation of. And obviously, the connective tissue being that he's a character in Stray Gods.
Yeah.
And that was sort of ultimately, like, I've known him a lot longer than that, but collaborating together on Stray Gods is what kind of brought us closer. And he's just a joy. And he really moved me with that show.
Yeah. I put a few seconds of a reel today that I posted on Instagram. And just in case you guys wondered, what was that person like seemingly rapping?
That's yeah, Anthony. You were mixing it with music. That's not his show.
Yeah. But no, they were rocking. But yeah, that's his show. And loved it. I am grateful I got to come with you and experience that. And the idea for you was to go see the show and come back home. And I'm like, how about We escaped for 2 days.
Well.
So, yeah. It was
yes, it
really
was.
Nice.
Really, really great. Alrighty, that's it from us. Thanks for listening, everybody.
You guys, we are going to hit 1 year of this project. So I think I am going to do something special for our dear listeners. We still have one microphone that we want to give away. And I might do like a little like care package with goodies. I'm thinking a t-shirt and bookmarks and pretty cute stuff for anybody who's like fan of, well, not fan, but like if you're a current listener, this might be lovely for you. So yeah, keep an eye on our social media and we'll keep you posted.
Yay! What is that laugh?
Thank you.